Great to see everybody. Let's go. Let's continue. I gave you my whole background of why I was gone the last 2 weeks, but here we are. And we are up to chapter 132. Ah, the long-awaited 132 that I pushed off until I had no choice. Okay, here we are. 132. Let me put it up on the screen so we have it. There we go. 132. Okay, Shir HaMaalos, shocking, I know. Shir HaMaalos, a song of ascents. Zechor Hashem LeDavid, Eis Kol Unoso. Remember Hashem unto David and all his affliction. We'll come back to that. That he swore to the Lord, he vowed to the mighty one of Jacob, David, that I shall not come into the tent of my house. I shall not go up on the bed that was spread for me. I shall not give sleep to my eyes nor slumber to my pupils. Until I find a place for the Lord, dwellings for the mighty one of Jacob. King David here is telling us, well, I shouldn't say it that way. The psalm begins, remember all of the affliction of David. What exactly does that mean? We'll come back in one moment. But what did David do? David swore up and down that he was not going to enjoy anything in this world, meaning he's not going to go ahead and build his own palace. He's not going to lay down and the beautiful beds that were spread for him. He's not going to take a little sleep, nor is he going to have slumber until he makes sure that there is a place for God, a dwelling place for Hashem, the Beit HaMikdash. Now, fascinating, we all know, after our many conversations, David is not the one who built Temple Number One, although he wanted it so badly. If you were to ask Moshe what his number one request of life in life would be, he would tell you to go into the land of Israel. And if you were to ask David, if you ask King David what his number one desire in his life was to build a temple for God, neither one of them had their lifelong dream fulfilled. Moshe was not allowed into the land of Israel, nor was King David the one to actually build the Beit HaMikdash, the temple that was reserved for his son Shlomo, King Solomon. However, throughout Tanakh, throughout the Talmud, everywhere we look, it is always called and referenced. The credit of the temple is given to David. Yes, Shlomo actually built it. And in historical context, yes, it's the house that Solomon built, but everybody refers to it as the house that David built, even though he didn't build it. The credit is given to him. In fact, the verse in an earlier chapter, in chapter 30, Tehillim 30, tells us, it's a famous one, we say it in davening in the beginning, Mizmor Shir, a song, Mizmor Shir of that was sung, Chanukas Habayis, of the inauguration of the house, LeDavid. The inauguration of the house where after David had already passed away. But the credit is given to David HaMelech. Okay, this psalm that we're looking at, 132, there are three events that all relate to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple in Jerusalem. Three events. One, which we're going to see shortly, and that is the youth that in already as a young boy, he wants badly to identify the precise location of where the temple is to be built. Now, when I started looking this over, I was struck. What do you mean? Everybody knows where the temple was supposed to be built. We talk about it from the time of Abraham when he put Isaac up and he was binding him upon the altar. Did they not know that was the place? When Jacob has a dream of a ladder that goes from the ground all the way up to the heavens and angels coming and going, did he not wake up from his dream and say, is this not the place of God? We all knew where it was. So what does David mean, as we'll see, that he was going to find the precise place? We'll get there. The second part of this chapter of this psalm is where toward the end of King David's reign, of where he built an altar, not the temple, but an altar itself, a mizbeach, on that spot that he finally identified. And the third is the ultimate, is the construction itself by King Solomon, by Shlomo HaMelech, with that Mizbeach, with that altar that his father built as the focal point. That are the three events that are going to be going throughout this psalm. So let's go through it carefully. Let's go through it carefully. Let's start with the beginning. And that is, there's a certain sense that we're saying, Hashem, remember that even though David would not be the one to build the Beit HaMikdash, but still he gave all of his abilities to prepare everything. It was with a level in Hebrew we say of mesirat nefesh, of self-sacrifice. He put everything on the line to find and establish the place for the Beit HaMikdash, and he asks God to remember all of the effort. Now, it's worthy of note because in Judaism, as opposed to what it's like in the dog-eat-dog world in which we live, we'll come back to this in a second here. In the dog-eat-dog world that we live, where the only thing that matters is the bottom line. In Judaism, that is not true. It's obviously we want results, but the effort that's put forth is as important regardless of whether you succeed in the productivity or not. The example that's given is if you hire someone to make shoes for you, or you hire someone to make a dress or a suit, a custom suit, and he says, I need 2 weeks. He says, okay, fine. You come back after 2 weeks and the shoemaker only has one shoe, or the dressmaker has only one sleeve, right? Or the suit, the jacket is only half done. And the guy says, listen, I'm sorry. I tried my best. At least pay me for half. You know, I gave you half a suit. I gave you half a dress, or I gave you one shoe. You should pay me at least half of what we agreed on. How many of you are going to pay that? Your answer better be none of you, right? Unless you're just so magnanimously rich that you can just give away money. That you're not going to pay anything. Why? Because you didn't get the product. I'm sorry that you tried. I'm sorry you put in all the effort. But at the end of the day, I asked for a pair of shoes. I asked for a full dress. When it comes to Torah, when it comes to Judaism, when it comes to spirituality, it's the effort counts in and of itself, regardless if you succeed. King David here says that even though I am not the one that actually will build it, you know, God, how hard I tried. I gathered all the materials. I made sure that the land was secure from its enemies so that the situation was such that the land could be, the Beit HaMikdash could be built. I did all of this. I ask you to please remember the effort. And I took an oath, King David says, that I will not enjoy. I won't have my own palace. I won't have my own creature comforts. Until you have your Beit HaMikdash, until you have the place where your great Shechina, where your divine presence can now come and dwell. I took such an oath. But let's look at the words here for a second. Hold on. What up? He swore to the Lord, he vowed to the mighty one of Jacob. In Hebrew, it's Nadar La'avir Yaakov, to the mighty one of Jacob. Now, as we often do, we ask ourselves, why does King David choose specifically this patriarch? The truth is, he could have said, I swore to the Lord, he vowed to the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Could have picked any of them. Why does he specifically choose Jacob number one? And why specifically this terminology, the mighty one of Jacob? Fair question, correct? What would you say? Let's see how much you remember from your reading of the Torah over the years.
Does it have to do with Jacob wrestling with the angel?
It sure does. Excellent, Muriel. Excellent, excellent, excellent. In fact, that is exactly where the terminology is used. Verse reads as follows. It's actually a little later, but Memtes. Memtes Chafdalid. It's talking about Joseph, actually, but it's in reference to Yaakov. His bow was firmly in place and his arms were gilded from the hands of the mighty power of Jacob, Midei Avir Yaakov. The exact same terminology, the mighty ones. And Rashi tells us, what is that referring to? That's referring to the fact that Yaakov was given the strength to fight the angel, and there were other human foes as well. When Yaakov refers to Hashem, he refers to him as my mighty one, because you, God, allowed me and helped me in all situations, and you supported me against angels, against man, against any foe that came my way. You gave me the strength to do it. David HaMelech here is saying, I make the same promise to the one who stood by me in every situation. I am making a vow that I will not have any of these creature comforts until you have your Beit HaMikdash. But there's really more to this, because Yaakov is the one is who had the dream of where the Beit HaMikdash would be. Remember, we talked about it with the ladder. He has a dream and he says the words, Ein zeh ki im Beit Elokim. This is nothing other than the house of God. So he knows this is it. Says David, I'm making a promise that I will find the precise location. Yes, we may have known from the earlier years about the general location of where the Beit HaMikdash, but where exactly on the mountain will it be? Either Yaakov didn't remember it when he awoken, or he wasn't revealing it because God didn't want him to. Whatever the case was, people may have known the general locale of where the temple was to be, but it did not know the precise location until King David. He's the one who actually finds the spot. I will not come into the tent of my house. I will not go up on the bed spread for me. Sounds a little like a Dr. Seuss. I shall not give sleep to my eyes nor slumber to my pupils until I find a place for the Lord. Please note this word. I'll bold it for you. What does it say?
Dwellings.
Dwellings
Dwellings,
in the
plural.
plural. Interesting. Why? I thought it's a dwelling.
Dwellings, yeah, plural.
Plural.
Yeah. Why? But isn't the Beit HaMikdash singular?
Dwellings for everybody. It's everybody
No,
within.
that would be. That it wouldn't be the dwellings.
Dwellings is the place.
But you all know the answer.
But
How
God is in many places.
many? No, that this is until I find a place for the Lord, dwellings for the mighty one of Jacob. There's only one place, there's only one area, one locale for the Beit HaMikdash. But how many temples have there been?
Oh, was this the tabernacle that was carried, the portable?
No, I'm asking you, how many temples have been in our history? Yeah, Gene knows.
Oh,
Two. And what are we davening for every day?
a third
For
temple.
the third one. David knows this. He's going to find a place for the Lord, a singular place that ultimately will have dwellings. Temple number one will be there for 410 years. Unfortunately, will be destroyed. We will come back and build temple number two that will stand for 420 years, unfortunately destroyed. But there will come a time of where, in that same location, we will have temple number three. Hence, he says a place, but dwellings in the plural.
Rabbi Tay, I have a question.
Please.
Why is Jacob not referred to as Israel?
Great question.
Way to go, Miriam.
Excellent question. There. I want to see your face. There we go. It's much better.
It's one of my favorite stories, so I have a million questions.
Okay. This question can be asked in any time throughout the Torah where sometimes he's referred to as Jacob and sometimes he's referred to as Israel. And the question is, why is that name chosen in every specific place? So let's differentiate two things. Number one is that there were other people who had name changes. For example, Avram becomes Avraham. Sarai becomes Sarah. However, if you read the text carefully, when the Torah gives Avram and Sarah their name changes, he makes it clear that that is the new name, never to be referred to by the other ever again. In fact, the Talmud says that someone who refers to Avraham by Avram has committed a terrible tragedy, has really done a terrible thing. We don't refer to him as Avram unless we're reading the story before his name change, obviously, in the Torah. But Avram becomes Avraham, never to be used Avram again. And similarly with Sarai to Sarah. However, when it comes to Yaakov, it does not say you will no longer be called Yaakov, only Yisrael, but also Yisrael. What the sages teach us is as follows, and I've seen this in many, many works. Brilliant idea. The Jewish people, which we call ourselves the children of Jacob, right? Children of Yisrael, right? B'nai Yisrael, Klal Yisrael. The patriarch we most connect with, if you want, is Jacob. He's the one, okay? The Jewish people live on two planes. And I'll try to do this the best I can. The Jewish people have a terrible habit, Muriel. We either are super good or we're super bad. Very rarely are we in the middle. That's the nature. In fact, the Torah actually identifies it and tells us that when we follow the Torah, it says that we will be mala mala, higher, higher, like the highest. And when we stray from the Torah, it says we will fall mata mata, lower, lowest. It doesn't say you'll fall low. It doesn't say you'll go high. It says the highest of the high and the lowest of the low. And that's the nature we've always been. When we get into a country, we become productive members of that society. We rise to the highest echelons of every society we've ever been. And when we fail, man, do we fail. We go down to the doldrums. Who are the ones who come up with the worst isms? Who come up with the worst depravity out there? Very often it's Jews. That's who we are. We go way up or way down. The name for the Jewish people are represented by the two names of Yaakov. Yaakov, what does his name Yaakov come from? Why is he called Yaakov?
Heel,
Because it comes
heel.
from the heel, Akev. Right? He was holding on to the heel of Esav. That represents the lower level, the lowest level. The heel is the bottom of your body. Yisrael, how did he get that name? When did he get that name? After he had the battle with the angel, and the name Yisrael means to struggle and fight for what's right. Okay. The names reflect the lower level of the Jewish people and the higher level of the Jewish people. Throughout the Torah, you can find that when it talks about Yaakov, it's making a point. Either the Jewish people are not behaving properly, and therefore their association is with the lower level name, Jacob, as opposed to when we're doing the great things, we're called Yisrael, which I believe is the reason why we refer to ourselves as B'nai Yisrael, not B'nai Yaakov, because we strive for that high level. However, there are definite occasions of where, even in the good circumstances, we're called Yaakov. Why? Because it's a reference to even the lowest of the low has the potential to be high. Here, Avir Yaakov, he's saying, the mighty one, that God stood by me. Even if I were on my lower level, God stood with me. Why? Because he knew that I have within me the potential to override and to be better than Yaakov. So here you have it, right? He's called Yaakov, Avir Yaakov, the mighty one, because even in, sometimes people think that the good guys only stand up when they're doing well. Everybody wants to be friends with the guy who's being successful. How many people stand by when the guy's failing? How many real friends? They're real friends when they stand by you through thick and thin. Hashem stood by him even when he was Yaakov, even when he was on the lower level. You'll keep this thought in mind as you go through the Torah and you read the stories. Note which name is being used, Yaakov or Yisrael.
I just thought that in this context, because I'm aware of the shifting use of the name, but I thought this context was important enough and spiritual enough at a high level to be referred to as Yisrael
Meaning,
rather than Yaakov.
our psalm?
The psalm we're reading
Yeah.
from David's point of
Right.
view.
So I would say like this. I would say that no, King David looks at himself and he says, listen, I'm not worthy enough to build the Beit HaMikdash. I'm not on that high spiritual level as high as I could be. How do I know? Because God's not giving me that privilege to build it. So and maybe in his own mind, he thinks of himself as a Yaakov, not as a Yisrael.
I love
And yet he recognizes Avir Yaakov, the mighty one. Maybe suggestion.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's keep going here. So now we begin to look at what he says through error number one. Let's look at verse six. Behold, we heard it in Ephrat. We found it in the fields of the forest. King David tells us that I have a tradition. When I was still a young boy in the area of Ephrati, right? That's where he was, Bethlehem. I heard it from my younger years that one day we will know the actual site of the Beit HaMikdash. Everybody knew that the temporary dwelling where the tabernacle was in Shiloh, in Nov, in Givon, in all these places were only temporary. I knew. As a young man, and therefore I went ahead and I built a mizbeach, an altar, in a place called Garon Arona. That's the name of the place. And if you read in the book of Chronicles at the very end of Tanakh, Divrei Hayamim, it's one of the last books. What we find it tells the story, the chronicles of history, and it says that David built an ark. He built an altar. A mizbeach there, and a fire came down and declared, "Zeh Beit Elokim. This is the spot. You have found it." Where was it? It was in the field of the forest. It's almost a contradiction in terms. You think of a forest as trees and trees and trees, and you think of a field with no trees, and it's an open area. So again, commentaries all discuss this. But it was an area of a forest, that is true, but he found or he created an open area within it. And that's where it was. It struck me, and then I found someone who actually discusses it. When you think of a forest, you think of a lot of brush, right? There's a lot of thick brush that's there. It's not just tall redwood trees, there's a lot of brush. Can you think of another story where a lot of a thick brush area was found or utilized in the story that relates to this site of the temple?
The burning bush.
No, not the burning bush. Good guess. Think back to the story of Abraham and the binding of Isaac. What's the end of that story? The angel stops Abraham from actually sacrificing Isaac. And what happens?
There's a thicket.
Yeah, and what's in it?
The ram is caught in it.
Yeah, the old ram. Yes, the ram is caught in the thicket. And that's the sacrifice that Abraham brings instead of his son. I believe, and I found this in some of the sources, that that's what's a reference here. And that is this area, this forest area, is exactly the place where that ram got stuck. This is the same area. Okay. Let us come now, he says, Since we knew this place of the Beit HaMikdash, since now we know, I should say, since now we know, from this day forward, let us come to his tabernacles. Please note the S. Let us prostrate ourselves to his footstool. Strange wording, strange words. What footstool? I get the part. Now that we know where the Beit HaMikdash is and it's going to be built here, let us come to it and let us prostrate ourselves completely to his footstool? What's a footstool? Anybody? What's a footstool?
Where you put your feet.
Okay, so how does that relate to, I mean, God needs a little ottoman to put his feet up. You know, it's rough running the world. I know. So what kind of footstool?
The altar?
Yeah, but what's the terminology of a footstool? Where do we nowadays, where would we use a footstool? So Muriel, you said you put your feet up. Where
I
is
use it
it
to reach everything.
Is it what you were saying before, like that the feet are the lowest, so that this is to raise up, like to raise, spiritually raise yourself
okay,
up?
Okay, good. But what are you sitting on the footstool?
No.
And in a regular case, forget God. Let's just say us ourselves. If you're using a footstool, you're sitting on a
chair,
a couch, a sofa, a lazy boy, and you put your feet up on the footstool, mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. Use that imagery. Huh? It's an amazing imagery because what you
Well, it says sometimes the
what?
Earth is God's footstool. The
Here
earth
you
is
go.
God's footstool.
That's exactly the point. And that is if you picture, and again, we're using terminology. It's not physical. God is sitting on the throne up in heaven. And the earth is his footstool. But it's not just the whole earth. If you want to know which area is in direct line of that throne, that's the area of the Beit HaMikdash. That's the temple site. That is the actual footstool. It is corresponding directly in line with the throne of God. It would explain why it's such a holy site, right? We've talked many times about the idea of that a spiritual realm and a physical realm, they're tethered to each other and they work in cahoots with each other. The footstool directly under the throne of God is the Temple Mount. It's exactly where it is, where the Beit HaMikdash is. Okay. Let's keep going.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Please.
Did David start building it and then he was told you picked the right spot? Or was he told this is the right spot to build it?
He did not start building the temple. He did not begin any construction of the temple. The only thing he did was that he figured it out, and he had help, but he figured out this was the spot, and he built an altar there just by itself. No walls, no coverings, no fancy building, just the altar. If you can, I mean, if you have the time, you can look it up. It's in Chronicles 1, chapter 22. That's where it talks about that procedure of how he found it and how he established that altar.
But it sounded like he got confirmation that it was the right spot.
Correct.
Did he get the confirmation before he built the altar or after?
After, I believe.
Okay,
it's
so
after.
He figured it out, he
yes.
built it, and then he was told.
He was given,
yep.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
That is
okay.
correct.
Thank you.
Okay, let's keep going here. Arise, now comes something very interesting. Kuma Hashem limnuchasecha. David here, King David now says, okay, God, I want you now that we have the site, arise to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. I want you to come, meaning, obviously, he doesn't mean at this moment. He means when the temple will be built, I want you to come bring your divine presence down here into your real resting place, you together with the ark. Not only that, but let your priests be clothed with righteousness and let your devout ones sing praises. That's your Kohanim and your Levim, right? The priests are the Kohanim, and the devout ones are the ones singing praises. That's the Levites. They worked together. The Kohanim would do the service, and the Levites would do the singing. Throws in, we're not done. For the sake of David, your servant, turn not away the face of your anointed. Fascinating. Three things are happening here. Number one is that I want you, he says, please, Hashem, arise from all your temporary dwellings, all your temporary locations, and rest your presence in this place forever. You and the Ark of the Covenant, that is the symbol of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. I want you to commit yourself that you will be in this place forever. No other temporary locations evermore. Even, I'll be bold to say, even if the dwelling itself gets destroyed, there will not be another temporary location anywhere else. It's this spot and this spot only. In fact, I'm not just blowing smoke. The Midrash actually says that even after the temple was destroyed, the divine presence never left the Kotel. It never left the Kotel. The Kotel, the Western Wall that we go to. The divine presence dwells there. Now, if you know anything about the architecture and the layout of the Beit HaMikdash, you know that the Kotel is not the wall of the temple. It's not. It's a wall of the outer courtyard that surrounded the temple building. So now, put your thinking caps on for a moment. Obviously, let's work from the inside out. The holiest spot within the temple itself would be what room?
The Holy of Holies.
Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That is the place. What was in there? Only one thing. The Ark. The Ark that housed the stone tablets that we got. Going out a little bit from there, you go into a building. It's called the Heichal. It housed both the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, as well as the other room we'll call just the Holy, Kodesh. That's called, that whole building is called the Heichal. As you move further out and further out and further out, you can understand that the level of sanctity goes down, albeit minimally, right? Because it's still quite holy, but it's not as holy as the Holy of Holies, okay? So if I tell you that God's presence moved from the Holy of Holies, the most sanctified place on earth, and the temple is destroyed, and God says, don't worry, I will never leave this area, and I will still keep my divine presence at the Kotel. Not the Holy of Holies, not the outside room of the Holy of Holies, not outside there where the Mizbeach, the altar was, not outside of that there were rooms with wood and oil and other supply rooms, not out there, not even in the court. I'm talking about the most external wall of the entire Temple Mount area. God says, I'm there. That is why the Kotel still holds such a dear place for all of us for all these years. Because the divine presence, this is where David says, never leave this place ever. And we'll see in verse 11, God says, you got it. But I want you to note three things. Number one, it starts with, Hashem, arise to your resting place that you and the ark should be there. Number two, the Kohanim and the Levites should do their job. And number three is that in my honor, don't turn away the face of your anointed, which he's referring to his son, Shlomo, you never turn away and let the dynasty remain in our family. These are the three things. Watch what happens in 11. 11, the Lord has sworn to David in truth, from which he will never turn back. Of the fruit of your body, well, whatever. Meaning your descendants, I shall seat upon your throne. Number one, you have my promise, David. It will remain in your family forever. If you're on condition, If your sons keep my covenant and this my testimony, which I shall teach them, also their sons will sit on your throne forever. There's a little asterisk that says, yes, it will stay in the Davidic line always. Little asterisk at the bottom, it says, but they better follow thy commandments. They still have a job to do. For the Lord has chosen Zion. He desired it for his habitation. I want to focus on this for one moment here. Okay? Verse 13, because God has chosen Sion. We've talked about this word Sion a few times. But this word, he desired it for his habitation. In Hebrew, I want you to see this word. It's got three Hebrew letters. Let me see if I can. Should I make this larger? Is it hard to see? Let's make this, if we can make this a little larger.
Good.
How do I do that? Oh, here we go. Move this over. Here we go. Here's the word. Eva. Eva lemoshav lo. He desired it as a place, like a moshav, right? What's a moshav? Is a, you know, there's kibbutzim and moshavim. These are places of dwellings. Eva means he desired. It's a funny word. We don't find it too often in Tanakh. So I have to share with you something as it relates to Purim. Let's go through this a little bit. It's off the topic, but I know Susan's going to love it. But just note, Aleph, Vav, Hey. You all see it? Aleph, Vav, Hey. Okay. Now you have to commit it to memory because I want to see everyone's face. Come on. Okay. All right, here we go. Story of Purim. We all know the story of Purim. Fine. Haman, boo. Okay. Haman comes from the nation of Amalek. We all know that. Great. I mean, not great, but fact. Okay. We know that. Okay. He comes from Amalek. The first time, other than when Amalek, the man, is born, he is Esav's grandson. Just FYI, Esav's grandson is Amalek. The first time we're really introduced to him is when they come as a nation and they attack us after the Exodus. It's a rare attack from the behind, and they attack the weak, the elderly, the frail, right? Those are the ones that they attack. And Moshe has to wage this war. He appoints Joshua to lead this war to weaken Amalek. They don't destroy them, unfortunately. Okay? At the end of that section, God says that I will have this war against Amalek from generation to generation. This is the way it's going to be. Why? And the term that's used, ki yad al kes ka, because the hand, ki, because yad, the hand, al is upon, kes, chaf samach, and then ka, ya, was Hashem's, truncated name, yud and hey. It's missing the vav and hey, right? Ki yad, because their hand is on case. Kaf samach is short for kisei. What's a kisei? Chair or throne, right? Ki yad al case ya. Their hand is on the throne of God. They're holding back the throne of God from being recognized throughout the world. Amalek stand as the antithesis of the Jewish people who are trying to bring God's name into the world. Amalek stands diametrically opposed to that, of not wanting God's name in the world. That's what Amalek stands for. Their hand is on the throne of God, holding it back, not to be revealed. And the Torah hints to it by truncating the words throne of God. Instead of kisei, throne, chair, it's kaf samach, leave off the Allah. Case, instead of kisei. And yah, yud and hey, instead of a yud, a hey, and a vav and hey. So throne of God gets truncated to thra-ga, if I wanted, to play a game. It's case is short for kisei, and ka is short for yud-ke, vav-ke. Okay, And a lot of Torah talked about this. I mean, everybody has a take on this. But I want you to pay attention, ladies and gentlemen. If the whole point of what Amalek stands for is to deny God's presence down here on earth, that's what Amalek's all about. Ask yourself this question. Why did Amalek attack us when we left Egypt? What did they want from us? We weren't bothering them. Their location where they had inhabitation, where they had habitation, was up north. They came out of their place. We didn't cross their land. We were no threat to them whatsoever. And they came from their location to attack us and not even have the decency to wage a war like everybody else and that you take them on. No, they come from the back and they attack the weak and those that are straggling. Come on, what kind of chutzpah is this? Because their whole point is, I don't want the Jewish people to get to Har Sinai. I don't want them to get to Mount Sinai so that they don't get a Torah. Remember, they attacked us before we got to Sinai. They don't want this mission of the Jewish people to bring godliness to the world. They'll do whatever they can to stop us. They stand as the yin and yang, everything. We always talk about a yin and yang. Well, if the Jewish people are yin, they're the yang. And therefore, everything we stand for of bringing godliness to the world, they're there to prevent it. And therefore, their hand, so to say, is on the throne of God. Or in this case, the Torah alludes to it by shortening those two words. Case, ka, ya. You following this? What letters are missing?
Aleph from Kiseh. And Vav and Hey.
Aleph from Kiseh and Vav Hey, yes. Hashem's name.
His name.
It's the word Eva that I just showed you. Look at this again. Kivachar Hashem Bitzion, for God desired. Right? He chose Zion. Eva Lemoshevlo. This is his desire to dwell here. His habitation down here on earth. Why? So that the Aleph, the Vav, and the He can be restored. And then we have a full name of Kisei Yudke Vavke. Kerplunk. This is a smidgen of a piece that I was reading when I was in Israel about this idea of how Haman and Amalek are all about not allowing God's name to be complete down here on earth. And how the Jewish people, our mission is just the opposite. Where our job is to bring Aleph, Vav, and Hey back down to the earth. Okay, but let's continue. Could I put my notes there? Okay. Let's keep going. Okay, he agrees in 14. Zos menuchasi, you got it, David. This will be my resting place forever. Here I shall dwell, for I desired it. There it is again. Evisiha, same word. Okay, so this corresponds to the request of where David said, for the sake. Sorry, the first one. Arise, O Lord, to your resting place, you in the ark of your might. You asked. 14, you got it. This is my resting place forever. Here I shall dwell, for I desired it. Then comes 15. 15, I shall bless its provision. Oh, well, we'll come back to this one. I shall save its needy with bread. I'll come back in a minute. Look at 16. Its priests I shall clothe with salvation, and its devout ones will sing praises. Directly, exactly what David asked for in number 9. Let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and devout ones will sing praises. You asked, I provide. And guess what? Comes along 17. There I shall cause David's horn to sprout. I have set up a lamp for my anointed. Very similar terminology. For the sake of David, your servant, turn not away the face of your anointed. But let's talk about this. There's two things here that still require a conversation. There's never enough time. I'm telling you, this is too good. Okay. In 15, he says, I shall bless its provision. I shall sate its needy with bread. This comes directly after God says that you got it. Because I desire this location, I will rest here forever. I will dwell here. And because of it, all the material well-being, all the needs of materialism will be provided. Because I desire this location, I will provide all the material blessings throughout the land of Israel, especially in Jerusalem, perhaps. If you think about it, this really is exactly what we say in the Shema every single day. Chapter 1 of Shema is all about a commitment, right? Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, God is one. We believe in one God. You shall love Hashem, your God. And we do all these things, and we promise we're going to love him, and we're going to serve him, and we're going to do the mitzvah of tefillin, and we're going to put on mezuzahs, and all blah, blah, blah. What's the next paragraph? Paragraph number 2. And it will be, and if you listen to my mitzvahs, if you listen and hearken to my mitzvahs, guess what? You know what I'm going to give you? Oh, Tachman is expecting to hear, I'm going to give you a spiritual world to come where you're going to sit blissfully. You think 2 weeks in Israel studying in the mornings is good? Man, have I got something good for you. Oh, man, you'll be doing this all day, every day. You'll be loving it. That's not what it says. It says, if you hearken to my mitzvos, guess what? I'm going to give you the rain at the right time, and everything's going to grow, and you'll have the early harvest and the late harvest, and you'll have for yourselves, and you'll have for your animal. All physical. It doesn't talk about any spiritual stuff at all. And then it warns us, because if you turn away, then I'm going to hold back the rains, and I'm going to make sure that you don't have what to eat. Whoa, whoa. That's the outcome? Yeah, that is the outcome. Because in this world, it's not about the reward of spirituality. God says, I want you to commit yourself to my mission, and I'm going to give you the means by which you can accomplish it. Imagine you go into the army and you commit yourself, and I'm on board. I go through boot camp and I go through training, and then they send me out there, no gun, no weapon, no camouflage, no fatigues. No, I can't do my job. I go and I go, I become a doctor, I become a teacher, I become, and they don't give you any tools to do it. You can't do your job. Hashem says, I will bless its provisions. I will sate even its needy with bread. Nobody will be lacking because this is my area. To this day, I tell you honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I do not know and I do not understand how the people of Yerushalayim in particular survive. I cannot wrap my head around there. Nobody has money. Nobody has money. And they're all living. I can't explain it. I can only tell you from the tiny little experience that I have had in my life of where I'm no complaints. God has provided for me. And Baruch Hashem, I'll tell you a crazy story. I get a call. And if it's one of you, don't tell me. I get a call from the rabbi of my shul. I'm in Israel. And I don't get a call from him because I swapped out my SIM card for an Israeli one so that I can make all my Israeli deal with it there. So all the calls didn't come through. I should really try that here in the States. I should just leave my Israeli SIM card. Probably better. But I got a message from my daughter, and then I got a message from my brother that the rabbi wants to talk to me. Now, the rabbi is not on a regular basis calling me. He certainly doesn't call me for advice. It's usually there's an issue. And I'm thinking to myself, oh man, what did I do wrong? That he's chasing me down? Okay. I track him down. I call him and I say, Rebbe, I'm sorry that I heard you were trying to get a hold of me. And what's the story? The story is the reason why he called is because somebody walked into his office a couple of days earlier and said, I know that Rabbi Tuchman is making a wedding. And I'm sure that he doesn't have extra money. But I have such gratitude for what he's done for me. I want to give him money, but I know he'll never take it directly from me. Rabbi, I'm giving you the money, and I want you to cut him a check from the rabbi's discretionary fund to cover it. Not the whole wedding. It was a nice donation. I have no idea who it is. Each of you can take credit. That's fine. Whatever. Right? I have no idea who it is. But this is Hashem sent me some extra money. It's tight this month. Yeah. Baruch Hashem. I don't understand, but Hashem seems to provide for all these people, millions of people. The economy is terrible. Do you know what? It's $100. It cost me 100 American dollars to fill up the gas tank of the car I rented. One tank, $100. And I didn't get a luxury SUV. It's crazy.
Wow.
But they're all living. They're all making it somehow. I believe that it's a direct result of this psalm. This is my resting place forever in verse 14. Here I shall dwell, for I desired it. And therefore, I shall bless its provisions. I shall sate its needy with bread. I can't explain it. Logically, it makes no sense. But that is the fact. Even the poor will be provided for. Why? Because my Shechina, my divine presence, now dwells here. Okay, let's finish this up. 17 and 18. 17 is amazing. 17 now corresponds to what David asked before, that in my honor, I want to make sure that the anointed one is all taken care of. But please note two things. Number one, I shall cause David's horn to sprout. That one has struck me for years because I say it every day in my davening, every day in Shmona Esrei, in the Amidah. Matzmiach keren Yeshua. That caused to sprout the horn of salvation. What's up with the horn of salvation? I mean, there's the horn of Africa. What is a horn? What's that got to be? What's this talking about? And what's the terminology to cause it to sprout? I mean, what is this? This is a four-leaf clover? We want it to sprout? So very quickly. Listen to this. Two things. Number one, horn is a symbol of strength. It's a symbol of strength. Why do I know that? Because that's what the ox uses. That's what the antlers on deer are for. It's the ram's horn is a sign of tremendous strength. In fact, the Gemara says something interesting. The Talmud says that when King David and King Solomon were anointed as king, they did it from a horn-shaped flask. However, Saul, who was the first king of Israel, he was just used a jug. It was foreshadowing that the jug is breakable. The horn, if you anoint someone with a keren, with a horn, it's a symbol of strength that endures. One interesting thing. But then the second word is this idea of sprouting. And I love this idea. Because we all have this picture in our head that salvation comes in the blink of an eye. You close your eyes and boom, everyone's saved. Boom, Mashiach will be here. That's not how it works. It is a slow and methodical growth. It comes la'at, la'at. Slowly, slowly, slowly. It doesn't happen all at once. Could it? Of course it can. But typically speaking, it doesn't happen overnight. Let's even talk about the Purim story. Yeah, there were pivotal moments, but how long was the story? From the time Achashverosh made his 180-day party to the time Haman and his sons were hanged, how much time elapsed? Take a guess.
A month?
Years. Not even close.
100 years.
Okay, now you're pushing it. 4 years. It was more than 4 years. Yeah. Yeah. But piece by piece by piece by piece, all the pieces of the board had to be put in the right place, and that takes time. Could God do it in the blink of an eye? Absolutely. And we trust he could do it and would do it. Typically speaking, what happens is everything gets revealed slowly, one piece, one piece, one piece. It's like sprouting grass. It doesn't just boom, there it is. It sprouts. But then he talks about setting up a lamp, arachti ner. See, the job of a king is twofold. One is to take care of the physical needs of his people, and number two, as important, if not more important, is to set the spiritual example for the people. And that's what here God says. There I shall cause David's horn to sprout, and I will make sure that it's strong and he will be a good leader. And additionally, I've set up a lamp, Ner. We all know very, very often, a lamp is always a symbol of Torah. It's always the symbol of spirituality. When somebody passes away, what do? We have a candle for Yizkar or for a Yahrzeit. It's always associated with a lamp, a little candle, because that's spirituality. That's the soul. As opposed to number 18, whereas the Kohens would serve God dressed in salvation clothing with beautiful, the enemies of Hashem will wear shame and embarrassment. They will see how wrong they were all this time. And upon the head of the king will be seen the crown of greatness, and it will shine throughout the world. This is a beautiful, beautiful chapter about what the role of the Beit HaMikdash is, what the role of the Jewish people are in relation to it, the role of the king as the role model for it. This is the chapter that I think explains it absolutely beautifully. What else can I add to this? I think I'll leave it at that. Any questions? Yes, Marty.
In doing some reading, the area was actually in the land of Binyamin. Is that correct?
Partly Binyamin. Most of it is in Benjamin, yes. There's a small part of it that's in Judah.
Okay, I was just wondering, because when you're talking about strength, and he, of course, is the wolf, it just seems appropriate.
Yeah, but the wolf doesn't have horns, so it struck me also. But yes, it's in Benjamin's territory. That's correct. That is correct. Yes.
A quick second thing.
Please.
Did this occur during a plague? Did David write this during a plague?
Okay, so I left that part out. Yes. There are commentaries that say that when David made a tragic error, and that is, you know, nowadays we're very careful. Most people know this, that you don't count people by number. If you want to see if you have a minion, you don't go 1, 2, 3, 4. Why? Because we have a tradition that you don't count people by number. The source of it might actually be what we just celebrated last Shabbos when we read the story of giving the half shekel for the census. Why? Because you don't count people. What they did is they collected a half a shekel and you counted the number of coins. That's how you knew how many. King David made a tragic error and he actually had a census and he counted the people. And a plague broke out. And unfortunately, many, 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 many died. That story is the precursor to this psalm. So, yes. Yes, Susan.
Well, first, I think Marty needs to get brownie points for even raising that question up. I'm just saying, because that's really wonderful. Two things. Does the idea of sprouting being a slow, methodical process, is that also true of healing?
Of healing?
Healing.
In
terms of, you know, the Jewish idea about it, that it takes time, it goes through its paces.
I gotta think
all kinds. Okay,
you can get back about that.
Okay, you can get
it
back to me.
It doesn't. Nothing comes to mind immediately. I gotta think about that one. Not sure.
Okay. Okay, the second thing I wanted to say is that I am really stunned to hear that the Purim story, the time frame of this happening, because how I bet that is going to be a showstopper to most people who are familiar with this story. And part of it too is that it seems so okay, the whole idea of, you
I'll
know,
put it in perspective for you, Susan. How long did the beauty pageant last? Every girl from the kingdom, right? And again, 127
Oh,
and
yeah. I
each of
guess
them
that.
gets 6 months, 6 months to doll themselves up in one place and 6 months in another place. And you're talking, who knows how many girls? The pageant itself probably was almost 4 years. Yeah, we read the story and we're just like, okay, it's all we read it in one night, and we're like, oh, great story, and it all happened, you know, like from Monday. But if you were on vacation for a week, you missed it. No, this was a long story.
But the whole idea of things turning on their head, you know,
Yeah,
half
for the
full,
hot bowl, yeah.
that whole concept of doing that, that's not a slow motion
Why
concept
do
in
you
my
say that?
head.
Every
I
stop.
don't know.
Okay.
it just
The
it's I
concept,
think that
I know. I grew up the same way you did. I didn't know that, right? But if you go through it, the fact that what's the idea? Every step that Haman or Ahasuerus or Mordechai or Esther took, every single step along the way, however long it took, was exactly the opposite. Everything was turned upside down. Now, you and I think of it in quick terms because that's the world in which we live. Everything is instantaneous, and therefore we assumed it, but it's not necessarily that case.
I think other stories that we have, I have a much clearer idea of the time frame. And I just think like this real, I wanna go now with my Mishloach Manot baskets and say, you have to like raise this up. I just think this is like incredible.
I would
Am I
recommend
the
highly go find one of these great. There's got to be fantastic books out there, probably in art school somewhere, you know. And it gives you the entire historical context of this. How did Ahasuerus become king? It's not in the Megillah, but it's a crazy story. How Ahasuerus, he is not the direct heir for the throne. His wife Vashti was. Vashti is the great granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the temple, for goodness sakes.
I mean, and you really thought that it was the letters that would get to, you know, those letters would do it.
There
This is the surprise for me
you go.
tonight. So
Okay.
thank you.
I
Thank you
guessed
for
wrong. Darren.
that.
Go ahead, Sharon.
Okay, so two things. One, when you were saying about counting people,
Yeah.
so I learned that over the few years that I worked in school, that of course we count the children when we leave the building, when they come into the building, but we don't count one, two, three, four. So there's different ways that we count them, but yeah, that's true. We don't count them one, two, three, yeah.
One of my favorite is that when we want to count to see if we have a minion, I saw this once and I was like, "What's he doing?" The guy was going around. He goes, "Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Hamotzi Lecha Min Haaretz," and I'm like, "What?" And then it dawned on me that bracha is the only one that has 10 words.
Oh,
So
I need to find 17.
he started counting. That's how
So
he counted to make sure we had 10.
another thing was that in the book that I have,
Yeah.
up at the top, it says sometimes it's a person's task in life to lay the groundwork for the great rather than to preside over the construction.
Yeah.
So that was David and Saul. And then it
David
said,
and Solomon, right.
yeah, so then there's another line. It basically says that the person that constructed it gets all the glory, but it's, you know, he gets the final achievement.
But David, interestingly enough, I didn't get a chance to say it, but when King Solomon was built the temple. And he was ready to bring the ark into the Holy of Holies because this is like the inauguration of all. The Talmud says that the gates of the temple didn't open. It refused to open. Why? He starts praying. King David, I'm sorry, King Solomon is praying 24 different kinds of prayers. The gates don't budge. The ark is waiting to go in. Everybody's like, what's the delay? What's the delay? And then finally, he utters these words, Bavor David Avdecha, in the merit of David, your servant. Gates open up and the ark goes right through. It was indicative of exactly that point of where, while David didn't construct it, He laid the foundation for all of it. It was his leadership, his procuring all of the materials, his making sure, as I said, securing the land, all of that. And the recognition does go to David. The ark doesn't go in until it's recognized that this is in David's merit. You're right. What else? We good? Excellent. Fabulous. Wonderful. All right. So next week, God willing, we'll meet again, but we're going to focus on Purim. Okay? I don't know if I'll have any more Aleph Vav Heis for you, but we'll find something good. All right. Have a great night, everybody.
Thank
Thank you so
you.
much.